This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection, and I'll introduce my guest shortly. Before that, I want to comment on something that happened to me this weekend. On Friday night, I was listening to Bill Moyers, he was interviewing a Cigna Health Insurance executive, or an ex-Cigna Health Insurance executive, and it really dawned on me after that program was over that maybe it's worthwhile at least making a little editorial comment about this whole issue of our reconsideration of our healthcare system. I hope most of you who are listening realize that Congress is now considering changes that will perhaps affect our healthcare system. And for the first time ever, a significant consensus of Americans now agrees that changes to how we provide and pay for healthcare are needed. The primary reasons for this consensus are threefold. One, there are now 44 million Americans without health care insurance. Two, compared to other developed nations, our health care scorecard overall is not good. In fact, it might be described as poor and is not improving. It's actually worsening. And three, despite these two previous problems, we spend almost twice as much on health care as most other developed countries. So in short, we're not getting our money's worth in this country on health care. If you're happy with our current health care system, then obviously you don't have to do anything. However, if you're hoping for some change, then you need to do some work. Otherwise, the status quo will continue as well. My suggestions would be first to keep an open mind. Second, educate yourself about the discussions going on and the health care options being considered. But also be careful. There's a lot of misinformation on these issues. Either do your homework and check out the facts that you hear or read, or find information online or on the radio or on TV that you can trust. For me, public broadcasting system and National Public Radio offer reliable and unbiased information. And a particularly good place to start if you want to come up to snuff on this issue would be to listen to or download and read the transcript of Bill Moyers' interview with the former Cigna Health Insurance executive Wendell Potter. A link to this program and several other websites I might suggest for basic information are listed on our Line One website. In addition, in the last year or so, we've interviewed several healthcare economists and physicians who are also educating us about our healthcare system and its problems and some proposed solutions. So you can go to ksk.org/line1 and search our archive and listen to those programs. And finally, then, let your senators and representatives know your thoughts. And the reason for this is, whether you know it or not, lobbyists representing organizations' resistance to any change are spending millions in an effort to control the results of this debate. Today, my guest is Andrea Wang. Andrea is a urogynecologist. She has an extensive educational history. She did her undergraduate work at MIT and then medical school at St. Louis University before completing seven more years in training at the University of Maryland and Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. And I'll let her describe that training a little bit later. Andrea, welcome to Line One.
Thank you, Thad. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. So my first thought when I heard about urogynecology is, what is that?
What is
and
that?
And I'm a physician. So let's assume people listening don't know what urogynecology is all about. Tell us.
Sure. Urogynecology is a subspecialty within the field of obstetrics and gynecology. And this field was developed specifically for the treatment of pelvic floor disorders. We have an entire hour, hopefully, to discuss that a little bit further. But in brief, pelvic floor disorders address the include the issues of urinary incontinence and prolapse. there will likely be an increasing need for specialists within this field, and that's for two reasons. The first thing is that these issues of incontinence and prolapse tend to increase with age, particularly as women go through the menopausal transition. And one thing we know about the population in the United States is that we are going to have increased numbers of women in that population or in that age group. In particular, the baby boomers are reaching an age where they may start to notice some changes in their pelvic floor. The second reason that urogynecology will most likely be more important is that we're paying more attention now to issues dealing with quality of life. Now, while the issues of pelvic floor disorders are not life-threatening, they can have a significant impact on a woman's quality of life. And many of my patients want to have a comfortable relationship with their body. They want to be able to maintain a healthy sexual relationship. They're not comfortable with the idea of needing to wear pads or diapers. And when the symptoms of pelvic floor disorders become severe, they can result in a woman's restricting her social activities. She might not want to go out with friends because of fear of odor or incontinence. She might start to limit her relationships with her partner. And these are issues that are very serious and deserve medical attention.
You know, those are excellent thoughts, and it makes sense to me that you would need subspecialization for those particular things. But it raises in my mind this whole question. Again, I'm thinking of the listening audience is, how come an obstetrician gynecologist can't do this? Or why can't a general surgeon be involved in it or a urologist and so forth? So why do we even subspecialize even within that those domains?
Well, that's a good question. And many generalist OBGYNs, in fact, do deal with these issues. When it comes to a surgical specialty, what you are winning with a specialist is more experience in that particular field. So I've sacrificed some breadth in my practice in order to pursue issues in urogynecology more deeply. So what this has involved is 3 additional years of training that has been approved by both the boards of urology and of OBGYN dealing specifically with pelvic floor disorders. And so that just amounts to having a larger number of surgical procedures under my belt and 3 years of focusing exclusively on this one particular area.
So if in a sense, I'm hearing if you do it a lot and you do the same thing over and over, you're better than somebody else. And so the outcomes are better.
Outcomes may be better. And one thing we know from the literature in surgical training is that the thing that is most associated with prevention of complications is simply experience. So you can imagine if you've done 1,000 of the procedures, you are probably much better at it than if you only do a few of the procedures. So we do notice a decrease in complication rates when it comes to surgical experience. Now, that's looking at surgery in general. I don't think there's any study that shows in particular that there are fewer complications for urogynecologists in general
compared
to the general population. But I think any woman needs to be comfortable asking her surgeon and her doctor how much experience they have with a particular procedure or a particular condition and, you know, asking what their outcomes have been because everybody's very individual.
Is it fair to ask, or I guess I'm curious to some degree as the way I should put this, is why is it then that having experience with the same procedure over and over makes it better? You're more familiar with the anatomy, you're more familiar with unusual situations at the time. What is it? What makes that the outcomes better if you're doing the same thing over and over?
I think it's both of those things. Definitely more familiarity with the anatomy. You know, I've done many courses in anatomy and I've actually taught some anatomy courses during my training. And every year I feel like I understand pelvic anatomy just a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something that definitely increases with your experience. Also, when it comes to using different devices and especially with surgical procedures, different surgical procedures, having experience with various types definitely, I think, increases the chance that you will do a better job.
Okay. Well, I couldn't help but notice that you had 11 years of training after medical school. Do you mind kind of – I think it's worthwhile also for listeners to hear what it takes to get to your situation with this kind of subspecialization.
Sure, absolutely. So after completing medical school, a urogynecologist will complete a residency either in urology or in obstetrics and gynecology. And following completion of residency, she or he will go on to pursue specialty training to become a urogynecologist. Now, some choose to pursue that on their own, usually by sort of apprenticing themselves to an expert in the field. And others choose to pursue a formal fellowship in urogynecology. And like I said, that involves 3 years of credit of training that is approved by the boards of OBGYN and of urology. You have to show that you're able to make a significant contribution to research in your field and to present a thesis at the end of your fellowship.
Mm-hmm. So you have a four-year fellowship, a residency, and then the fellowship, which
the
is
fellowship.
About 3 years.
Yeah, 3 years usually.
So there's the seven on top of four of medical school.
Exactly.
We're not even counting college. Okay. All right. Since we're going to talk about the pelvic area of women, if you wouldn't mind, let's try to do the very difficult job of explaining the significant anatomical and physiologic function of that area so that our listeners can hopefully keep up with some of the suggestions you're going to make if they have these symptoms.
Absolutely. So we can start by talking about the bony pelvis. And usually it's nice when I have a patient in my office because I can show them pelvic models and we can go over the anatomy together. And that's a very important part of my counseling. The pelvis, briefly put, is the girdle of bones that connect the lower part of your abdomen to your legs. If for the listeners that are listening from home, you can place your hands at the sides of your waist and kind of move them downwards towards your feet. And the first bones that you run into, which we sometimes think of our hip bones, those bones that you run into form the upper border of the pelvis or the pelvic brim. Now, to get a sense of where the lower boundary of the pelvis is, you can sort of focus on where the bones in your bottom come into contact with the seat when you're in a seated position. And that'll give you an idea of where the lower boundary of the pelvis is. The front of the pelvis is formed by the pubic bone, which some of us recognize, but you can feel that right at the very lowest part of your torso in the front. So to help you visualize this in 3D, it may help to know that the word pelvis comes from the old Latin term pelvis, which means basin or bowl. So the bony structures that I just described form the walls of this bowl, and the bottom of this bowl is formed by the layer of tissue that we call the pelvic floor.
Okay. And the pelvic floor is made up of...
The pelvic floor is a layer of muscle and other types of connective tissue that form the bottom of the bowl that we were just discussing. Mm-hmm. Now, this layer is very important because it's responsible for supporting all of the contents of your pelvis. So there are three major organ systems there. There's the bladder, which stores urine and then conducts it to the outside at appropriate moments. There's the female gynecologic system and reproductive system. And then towards the back, there's the ending part of the gastrointestinal system. So that's the rectum and the anus.
Mm-hmm. And so problems you're dealing with involve, as you said, issues related to the pelvic floor in particular. And maybe if you just give us, once again, an overview, and then I'm going to give out our phone number if people want to call, and we'll start into individual problems that you've maybe listed here.
Right. Okay. So with the pelvic floor, like all other parts of our body, this tends to change as we age. And women go through many transitions in life, as I was just discussing with a colleague this morning. You know, we grow up, we go through menarche, we start having our periods, many of us go through our childbearing years, and then many of us go through menopause. And the pelvic floor changes significantly with each one of those stages in life. There's usually a fairly large change if someone goes through pregnancy, because you can imagine all that additional weight is placed on that the bottom of the bowl that we mentioned, or the pelvic floor. And then changes tend to happen again as we go through menopause. And because of changes in the estrogen level, we can notice that there is a loss of support of the pelvic organs. So there's two major issues with pelvic floor disorders. This includes urinary incontinence, and vaginal prolapse. And most of us know what incontinence is, but just briefly, that's the involuntary leakage of urine. So the urine comes out when you don't want it to come out. Pelvic organ prolapse occurs when one of your pelvic organs, meaning your bladder, uterus or vagina, or the rectum, that loses its supporting tissue. And without the proper support, it can fall out of its normal position, and it can actually move outside of the pelvic floor. So a patient or a woman might experience this as a bulging sensation in the vagina or the feeling that she's sitting on a ball or some pressure in that area.
Mm-hmm. And other risk factors for pelvic floor disorders besides named age and mm-hmm. obviously female and obviously number of pregnancies or having pregnancy. Are there other risk factors that might indicate a greater risk as well?
Right, that's correct. When it comes to risk factors, I tend to sort of mentally divide these into two categories. There are modifiable risk factors and there are unmodifiable risk factors. So we all age. That's just the reality. Not many women will change to will base their decisions about childbirth on pelvic floor issues. So that I would consider an unmodifiable risk factor. But things that we can change are numerous, and that can include stopping smoking. We know that in addition to giving you respiratory problems that cause a lot of coughing that put pressure on the pelvic floor, smoking itself can actually weaken the tissues that support the pelvic organs. So that's one major thing. If you're a smoker, you should stop or at least reduce the amount that you smoke. And it also reduces your risk of bladder cancer. So definitely a very good thing in terms of a urogynecology standpoint.
What about weight and just overall conditioning? For example, do runners have less problems? Do weightlifters have more problems?
Mm-hmm. When it comes to weight, well, there's the issue of your body mass index. And you can probably imagine with the heavier that you are, the more pressure is placed on that pelvic floor, the bottom mm-hmm. of the bowl that we mentioned. So obesity is definitely a risk factor for pelvic floor disorders. It can not only increase your risk of it, but it can worsen the severity. But on the other hand, if somebody loses weight, you can notice a fairly large difference even with a pretty small weight loss. So as small a weight loss as 5% of your body mass index can result in reducing incontinence episodes by half. Hmm. Yeah, so there's always something that you can do to mm-hmm. improve the situation.
All right. What about exercise?
Exercise. Definitely your general conditioning and your general health will help maintain good pelvic support. We do tend to notice something called stress incontinence with activities that place pressure on the pelvic floor. So that can mean coughing, playing tennis, you know, anything that increases the abdominal pressure can cause a small amount of leakage. So there are situations where exercise can make it a little bit worse. But in terms of maintaining your overall conditioning, I think exercise is a good thing for your pelvic floor. And there are other specific pelvic floor exercises that you can do to try to prevent problems later on.
Okay. And I want to come back to that. So it sounds like weight loss and exercise have some advantages as well as the opposite of that, but they're not increasing your risk for some problems. And
correct.
All right. So we're going to take a short break. You're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
The recorded rebroadcast of today's Line 1 Your Health Connection with Dr. Thad Woodard will repeat tonight at 8, and an archived copy will be available online at kska.org following today's live broadcast. KSKA is supported by listeners like you and Providence Alaska Medical Center. Stroke is an emergency. Providence Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of a stroke. If you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headache without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence Alaska Medical Center. This is KSKA Anchorage.
And you're listening to Line 1. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard, your host. My guest today is Dr. Andrea Wang. She is a urogynecologist. So we're talking about disorders of the pelvis in women, particularly related to incontinence of stool or urinary symptoms related to incontinence, as well as some prolapse issues, which we hope to get to talk about today. If you've got questions or comments about anything you're hearing, or you have questions you'd like to ask in general, just give us a call at 550-8433. That's our local number, 550-8433. Our toll-free number is 1-888-353-5752, and you can email directly at lineone, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. All of those numbers are and email addresses are good through the next hour till just shortly before 3 o'clock. You can listen to the program again as a rebroadcast from 8 to 9 on KSKA, but we won't be able to answer your questions at that time. Dr. Wang, let's go get back to your topic and go over symptoms of pelvic floor problems again for me. And I'm asking you to do that just so perhaps our listeners, as we get into this kind of subspecialization, can identify perhaps a little better with what we're going to be talking about.
Absolutely. When it comes to urinary incontinence, we notice two major categories. The first is leaking with urgency, and the second is leaking with activity. So somebody that leaks with urgency feels the really strong urge to urinate and will probably rush to the bathroom, and they may not make it in time and start leaking urine while they're on the way to the bathroom. They may tend to go to the bathroom more frequently. They may have to wake up at night to urinate. Those symptoms all fall into the category of overactive bladder. The second category is stress incontinence. So usually you notice leakage of urine in small amounts when pursuing activities that increase the pressure on the pelvic floor. So that can be coughing, it can be sneezing. Sometimes it can be when you're arising from a chair, from a sitting to standing position. Anything that places pressure on that pelvic floor area can cause stress incontinence. And when it comes to prolapse symptoms, what often happens is that a pelvic organ will move outside of its normal position and start to almost herniate through the pelvic floor. And the easiest exit for a pelvic organ in a woman is the vagina. Mm-hmm. So you might notice some bulging or a feeling of increased pressure within the vagina. And if it's severe, the organ may actually prolapse outside of the vagina and come to the outside so it's visible.
Mm-hmm. How common are these issues of incontinence? And maybe, although men are not your subspecialty, if you'd help us understand, is this a bigger problem for women than it is for men?
Yeah, definitely much bigger of a problem for women. It's estimated that urinary incontinence is twice as common in women. So, you know, when I speak of incontinence issues as a urogynecologist, you know, I'm the person that's usually seeing most of the patients in the office for it. But yes, definitely above the age of 50, we usually estimate that between 30 and 50% of women have incontinence in some form. Now, they may not have very severe incontinence and they may not all find it bothersome, but given studies in the populations, we estimate from 30 to 50%. Similar findings with prolapse. Above the age of 50, we estimate that about half of women have some form of prolapse. And again, it may be mild. They may not know they have it, which is fine. But yeah, it's definitely a very, very common problem. And if there is anything that I convey during the show, it's that I want women out there to know that these problems are very common, that they're not alone, and there's almost always something that we can do. You know, just because this is something that we don't commonly discuss with our friends, I think a lot of women out there feel that they're very, very alone, and a lot of times I'm the first or second person that they've mentioned this issue to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be tough to talk about some of these issues. And the other thing that I hear, and I suspect you would agree also, is sometimes they've already tried other things, seen other providers, and it's still – things haven't worked, so they still are reluctant to try again. But I would think somebody that has very subspecialized training, it's at least worth running by their story again to see if there's some other suggestions you might have.
Yes, absolutely. And a lot of times, you know, even if surgery isn't required, there are many other things that we could do in terms of medical therapy or physical therapy or behavioral therapy that can help with the problem. So there's almost always a solution.
We did have an email come in early in the program wanting to know if you take Medicare patients.
Yes, we do. At Alaska Urological, we do take Medicare.
Yeah, I failed to mention that you are a local physician and you work for Alaska Urological Associates.
Yes.
And their office is on the Alaska Regional campus. And
That's
you
right.
work at both hospitals, I assume.
That's right. We admit to both hospitals. That's correct.
All right. What would be kind of the typical patient for you to see with incontinence? What's the age, the story, the symptoms that they're presenting with, and then their options for treatment?
Mm-hmm. I see women at generally two phases in their life. The first is sometimes after they've just had a baby. And obviously, vaginal delivery can put a lot of stress on the pelvic floor just because you are passing a very large object through an area that's very narrow. So what we've shown in tissue studies and in modeling of the pelvis using computers, that some of the muscle fibers in that area stretch to twice their length. And it's not just the muscle fibers, but the nerve fibers that feed that area as well. So sometimes there can be nerve damage, and that definitely affects the symptoms of incontinence and prolapse. So I see women maybe in their 30s after they've had a few children, then they're noticing symptoms in terms of incontinence and prolapse. The other age group is women that are after the age of menopause. So maybe somebody that's 55, 60 years old, she's noticed that things aren't quite the same. She doesn't quite have the control that she used to in getting to the bathroom. She's got some leakage of urine with activity. She may notice a difference in her vagina, especially when having intercourse. So that would be a second category of patient that I typically see.
Does problems early in life in that early group after pregnancies, let's say, predict reliably later problems?
I don't know if we have the data to answer that question. Yeah. One thing, well, there are some studies in fecal incontinence where we know that time seems to be a great equalizer. So there seems to be a group of women that experience changes right after pregnancy and delivery. But by the time you get to the 50s, 60s, 70s, your rates of incontinence and prolapse in women that have and have not had babies are approximately the same.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
we all end up in the same place.
Yeah. I didn't think about the effect on nerves, but that would potentially be a transient problem.
Right. Sometimes transient, and sometimes you mm-hmm. can experience tears in that area that need repair.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes.
Mm-hmm. What are the non-surgical options for urinary incontinence?
Okay. Well, each type of problem has different non-surgical options. So in terms of prolapse, you have the option, if the symptoms are mild and the prolapse is mild, you have the option of pursuing pelvic floor rehabilitation. And those are exercises that are designed to strengthen the pelvic floor in order to provide better support for the uterus and for the vagina. And, of course, because this is an exercise program, it requires some dedication. And like any other exercise, if you stop doing it, then the symptoms might return. But it's definitely a very effective option for women with mild prolapse. And I usually advise that they pursue this under guidance of a physical therapist. There's also something called a pessary, which is a device that's placed within the vagina and used to support the pelvic organs. So it's not something that is a cure. It just kind of pushes the prolapse out of the way so it's not bothersome. So that's another non-surgical option for prolapse.
Does that option help in the sense that if you use a pessary, that maybe with time you won't need it any longer, or is it just an option to make symptoms less dramatic?
Just to make the symptoms less dramatic, it is not likely to actually repair the problem.
Mm-hmm.
So once the tissue is weakened, it's very, very difficult to restore the normal connective tissue. So the pessary is not a definitive option, unfortunately.
With exercises, give us some feeling about the success rate with that. Are you good at being able to predict who should be successful and who shouldn't be, and why is that? And then the other question that comes to my mind, what's the length of time for one to expect to see some benefit? Now, when do you say, hey, that's not going to work?
Right. When it comes to exercises, the major factor is simply motivation. So we have shown that pelvic floor exercises can increase the muscle tone and strength of that area very, very successfully, but it's a program that needs to be followed pretty diligently. if done under the guidance of a properly trained physical therapist and with continued exercises at home, many, many women can experience physical significant improvement. But again, it's all about the motivation.
Mm-hmm. And that's primarily for prolapse symptoms, or does that also include some types of incontinence?
Also effective for incontinence, mainly with stress incontinence. If you can imagine, the bladder sits right behind the urethra. The bladder sits right behind the pubic bone, and then there's a little tube that conducts urine from the bladder to the outside called the urethra. The urethra passes right through the pelvic floor, so you can close it off by contracting the pelvic muscles just at the right time. Mm-hmm. So if you learn to do that, and that's called a Kegel exercise, if you learn to do that, often you can prevent stress incontinence from happening altogether.
Remind our listeners once again, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection. Our topic today is disorders of the pelvic floor in women. If you've got questions about urinary incontinence, fecal incontinence, some prolapse issues in the vaginal area, this would be a good time to call and ask your questions or express your previous experiences. So let me give you some numbers again. 550-8433 is our local number. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email at line1. Once again, it's LINEONE at KSKA.org, and you can do that but till just before 3 o'clock, although the earlier you call or email, the more likely we're going to be able to get to your question. How about testing? We had met prior to this just to kind of go over some of the issues, and you made the point that testing was important, and I'd like you to talk about that and why it's particularly important.
Okay. Testing we perform mostly in regards to incontinence. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about two different types of incontinence on the show already, leaking with stress and leaking with urgency. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to distinguish between the two of those. And so I and many other doctors will perform something called urodynamic testing. And in this test, we put a little tiny catheter inside the bladder that has some special sensors on it that help you know what's happening. And through that tiny catheter, we slowly fill the bladder, and we can watch how the bladder responds to being filled. I can look at different things, including how the bladder empties itself, and it basically gives me most of the information I need to know about the function of the bladder itself. So that helps us guide our therapy. Some types of incontinence respond well to medications. Other types respond well to surgery. So it's pretty important to distinguish between those and types of incontinence so we do the right thing for the patient.
Mm-hmm. So the big issue is that you don't want to do the surgery on something that's not going to
exactly.
be beneficial.
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah.
So it sometimes seems a little invasive to do some of the procedures, these urodynamic studies, but at the same time, it's much better than having the surgery unnecessarily.
Exactly. And I have to say, most patients that have had the test usually say to me afterwards, "Oh my gosh, that was so much better than I thought."
Sure.
So I think the anticipation for this test is the worst part. And as little tiny catheter, it's not terribly uncomfortable. I think it's a little more embarrassing than anything else, mm-hmm. just because of the nature of the examination.
We haven't talked about fecal incontinence very much. Not as pleasant to talk about, but it's still significantly a very important issue. Just give me some basic information about that and how that might be different than urinary incontinence.
Right. With fecal incontinence, there can be, we usually call it anal incontinence.
Okay.
And so women can be incontinent of gas, of liquid stool, and of solid stool. We notice a lot of changes sometimes after there's been tearing of the anal sphincter after a delivery. So that's one time where younger women may notice a change. Mm-hmm. And then again, as we age, there's a tendency towards having a greater risk for having this condition. But again, it's something that can be very embarrassing for patients and very, very difficult to talk about.
Are there non-surgical approaches to that particular problem as well, or not so many?
Well, with this condition, it's important to know if the sphincter muscle, meaning the muscle that travels around the anus to help you hold the stool in or the gas in, it's important to evaluate the integrity of that muscle. If there's a tear in that muscle, for example, after a delivery, No matter how great shape the muscle is in, because it's not surrounding the anus, it's not going to close it off at the right time. So that's one thing that's important to check for. The other thing is checking for nerve function to that sphincter. And this can be done with something called an EOG, EMG or electromyograph. And that lets us know if the signals to the muscle are arriving there and telling the muscle to contract when it's supposed to. So those are two major things that need to be done in the evaluation of fecal incontinence.
I want to get to some of the surgical issues, but to stay away from surgery for a second, are there medications on either of the incontinence issues that are worth discussing? And again, talking about their success rates and then the inevitable questions of risk versus benefit.
Right. For incontinence, there's leaking with activity or stress incontinence. There's no approved medication in the United States, but the medication known as Cymbalta is approved in Europe for treatment of stress incontinence. And what that does is it increases the strength of the sphincter muscle surrounding the urethra. And again, the urethra is the tube that leads from the bladder to the outside. And if you increase the power of the muscle around it to close at the right time, then sometimes you can help cure stress incontinence symptoms. For leaking with urgency and urinary frequency and urgency, we have other medications that are known as anticholinergics, and they help to relax the bladder muscle. So just to back up a little bit, the bladder is basically a balloon-like structure that the wall of it is composed entirely of muscle. Now, when the bladder is filling up, you want that muscle to stay nice and relaxed. When you want the bladder to empty, you want that muscle to contract in order to squeeze out the urine past the urethra. So what happens in some ladies is that this detrusor muscle or bladder muscle tends to have spasms. So you know if you're having a bladder spasm if you feel the sudden urge, like, oh my gosh, I have to go to the bathroom right now. So that could be a bladder spasm. And anticholinergic medications help to prevent the spasms and also to help the tone of the bladder overall stay relaxed. So there's less of a problem with urinary frequency and urgency and incontinence.
And for fecal incontinence, not much medication-wise?
There are things you can do in terms of bulking the stool,
right.
You know, trying to stay away from constipation, trying to stay away from stools that are too liquid. So you want a good consistency of the stool, but there's no medicine to directly help with that.
Okay. We have a caller. I'm going to ask her to wait just a second, and an email message. But before we do that, I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, Your Health Connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line 1 on KSKA Anchorage. Tonight's edition of Line 1, Your Health Connection at 8 p.m. is recorded and is not accepting phone calls. Support for Line 1 comes from the Lake Otis Pharmacy. Walk in or drive through for medical equipment, support hose, and supplements. On Lake Otis, one block north of Tudor, the pharmacy with a wheelchair on the sign. Children given positive attention and experiences during their early years are more likely to become smart, productive members of society. High-quality early education translates into higher graduation rates, better job readiness, and less crime and welfare dependence. So when you support a young child, you're supporting the economy. For more on early learning, visit bestbeginningsalaska.org. Early learning, it's everybody's business. This message comes to you from KSKA and Best Beginnings.
This is Line 1. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today we're talking with Dr. Andrea Wang of the Anchorage Group Alaska Urological Associates. She's a urogynecologist, and we're talking about issues related to incontinence and some prolapse issues that happen in women specifically. And if you've got questions or comments, you can call at 550-8433 or our toll-free number 1-888-353-5752. And in addition, you can reach us by email at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Vicki, what can we do for you?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I, through the process of researching or trying to diagnose another health issue, it was discovered that I have two ureters, and I also have issues with frequent urination. I'm wondering if those two ureters have something to do with that.
The duplication of a ureter is a condition that is actually quite common and often goes undiagnosed. It should not be related to your concerns about your urinary frequency, however. The ureter, when it's duplicated, can have several different patterns, some of which lead to problems, other of which are completely benign. So without knowing the specifics of your particular condition, it's hard to address that. But no, it should not be related to urinary frequency or urgency.
Okay. Can I ask another question?
Of course.
It'll cost you a dime.
He's charging.
No. Go ahead.
I also had an emergency hysterectomy at the age of 27.
Oh, goodness.
And I've just had bladder issues ever since then. I'm prone to urinary tract infections, frequent urination, that kind of thing. And I'm in my 50s now. Mm-hmm. So I've been living with this for a while. I'm just wondering if, you know, without knowing more specifics, if there's things that I can do to
now,
help
Did you notice the bladder issues and the frequent urinary tract infections immediately after the hysterectomy, or has that been something that's developed over the years?
It was pretty immediate. Ever since that happened, I have had issues with...
Right.
And it was pretty immediate. I can't do anything that relates to a pool or a hot tub or, you know, ponding of water in a closed environment, anything like that.
Okay. Some things that can change with a hysterectomy include the innervation to the bladder and also sort of the orientation of your organs in relationship to each other because of the surgery. So one thing that we've wondered about over the years as gynecologists is, what is the effect of hysterectomy? Does it increase your chance of having problems with urination later? And if you look at the big studies on this issue, it does not make a big difference in terms of the bladder. But there are many other things that can cause issues with the bladder apart from the hysterectomy. So those are things that you may want to look into a little bit further. The other thing that can happen, particularly during emergency surgery where everything's a little bit rushed, is that you can have scar tissue form internally after any sort of procedure. And that can sometimes affect the organs, that can affect the bladder certainly. If the relationships between the bladder and the rest of your pelvis are not what they used to be, sometimes you can notice changes in your voiding function.
And is there exercise or certain procedures, something that I can do to minimize that?
Well, in terms of preventing urinary tract infections, there are many, many things you can do, sort of depending on your particular situation.
I've kind of figured that out. I'm just wondering if there's a group of exercises or something like the Kegel or something like that would help.
Help in terms of the bladder issues or?
Just the frequency.
Okay, the urinary frequency. Okay. Mm-hmm. Assuming that you've ruled out an infection, because one thing that happens a lot of times with UTIs is that you get urinary frequency. So that's one of the major symptoms. So assuming that you don't have that, there are things called bladder retraining exercises or bladder reprogramming. And basically, what I say to my patients is it's kind of like potty training a little kid. So the idea is that we teach the bladder that it needs to wait till the appropriate time in order to urinate. So what I have patients do is I put them on the clock in terms of their urination. So instead of just kind of voiding when you feel the urge, we schedule your urination regularly, usually for every 2 hours or so. And when the sudden urge approaches, you want to do things to try to make that urge go away. So stop, don't rush to the bathroom, stand still, sit down, try to relax, and then visualize something that helps you imagine the pressure becoming less and less, or imagine the urgency slowly decreasing and running away. And once you feel that you're in control of your bladder, then you go to the bathroom. Because a lot of times it turns into a vicious cycle where you're like rushing, and then the bladder learns to expect that as the norm, that it's going to be able to empty if you go through the rushing to the bathroom procedure and you have that urgency. So the idea is that when you empty your bladder, you do it in a very relaxed state. And we start it with the scheduled voids every 2 hours or so. And then once you're good at that and you can avoid accidents at every 2 hours, you extend the time between voids by 15 minutes or so. And you keep that up until you are going every 3 to 4 hours, which is normal.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Do you also recommend regular intake of fluids as part of this process?
With fluids, I usually have patients keep a log of what their intake and output is. Now, you sort of hear about needing to consume 8 glasses of water a day. And so if you consume 8 ounces glasses of water, that ends up to a gallon of fluid intake every day, which is a lot of urine to be making because what goes in must come out. So that's a lot of water. So there are certain groups that suggest that unless you're an athlete or pursuing a lot of physical activity that involves sweating, that you just adjust your fluid intake according to your thirst level. The other thing you can do is look at the color of your urine and kind of aim for a light yellow color. You don't want it to be too dark, which would tell you that you're a little dehydrated, nor do you want it to be really clear, which might tell you that you're overhydrated. Okay. So you want to find that right balance for your fluid intake. And one good way to do it is to keep a log for a while.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for taking
Vicki, let me ask a question just quickly. I assume since you've had your hysterectomy, you've had some evaluation and a workup for your problems.
Not a formal workup, no. It's just been I like to avoid any medication when it's at all possible. And so I've learned what triggers the urinary tract infections, and I avoid those issues. Mm-hmm. But particularly as I've gotten older, I've noticed there's just been an increased frequency in the need to go to the bathroom.
Yep. And it may be worthwhile to look at it all again.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. Bye.
We have another caller. I'm going to take Catherine. What can we do for you?
Hi, I'm a 67-year-old woman and have occasional pressure in my bilateral groins, but generally on one side. And then also that has caused limping on whichever side it would be occurring on. When I have gone to medical practitioners regarding this, they've asked me the question of do I have incontinence along with it? And I can pretty much correct that limping if I bicycle, exercise really well. My question is how much incontinence is caused by nerve impingement as opposed to other things going on there in the pelvic floor?
Nerve impingement. I would say that's one of the less common causes of incontinence. When it comes to stress incontinence, for example, what we see is sort of softening of the pelvic floor tissue so that when you cough or sneeze or bear down, your urethra is supposed to close shut. And if the supporting tissues are a little bit weak, then they may allow the passage of urine outside of the urethra when you're not intending it. Nervous system problems in general and nerve impingements problems in general are not the more common causes of incontinence, but they can definitely exist. So that's one situation where I would definitely advise further evaluation with a physical exam.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call. And an email. This is from a physician's assistant, and she mentions that she has been seeing an uninsured patient. She does a lot of work in shelters, apparently in halfway houses, perhaps. And this person, woman, has been diagnosed with vestibulitis, she says. She says that's a posterior vaginal pain accompanied or with mild incontinence, and she has, in quotes, Q-tip touch. So a posterior vagina is quite sensitive. She was told that this was due to a, quote, unknown cause, unquote, and treated with topical steroids. Is there any information about this problem treatments? And I guess I'll ask, have you ever heard of it?
Yes, the vestibulitis, we refer to this constellation of symptoms as vulvodynia. So what that refers to is pain of the perineal area, meaning the skin that covers the area between your legs, pain of that area without an identifiable cause. So that means that you have to make sure that there's no evidence of infection, no trauma to the area, and nothing else that might be causing this pain. It's something that's very common. There is a good website. There's a National Vulvodynia Association that has some very good advice on the website in terms of lifestyle changes that you can go through to help with symptoms in that area. But yes, this is a very common problem and definitely very distressing to the women that have it.
So vulvodynia and vestibulitis, in your mind, are the same process?
Well, vestibulitis was the way we used to refer to it previously. But okay. I think that that constellation of pain in that area is now referred to as vulvodynia.
Okay. We have not talked about surgery.
Yes.
Tell us about surgery of these issues and what does it encompass, who's a candidate, and what's the success rate?
Okay. Surgical options are present for issues with prolapse and for stress incontinence. There are also some operations available for overactive bladder and urge incontinence, but those are more second-line treatments after somebody's gone through a trial of medical therapy. So when it comes to prolapse, usually I counsel a woman saying that she can either just kind of watch the symptoms, so we call that expectant management. I might say that I'll examine her in 6 months and see how she's doing. If she is bothered by the prolapse symptoms, she has the option of using a pessary. And again, just to review, that's a supporting device that we place inside of the vagina that kind of pushes the prolapse out of the way so it's not bothersome. And the third option is surgical management. So that is highly individualized based on a woman's particular anatomy. And our goal through that surgery is to restore your normal anatomy. There are various ways to do that. Our modern ways tend to be less invasive than procedures that they did even 10 or 20 years ago. So those are options for most women that don't have serious medical problems. When it comes to stress incontinence, that's one area where surgical options are very minimally invasive. So if somebody has the diagnosis of stress incontinence, they have the option of just kind of watching things, of going for pelvic floor exercises, or for having surgery. And the surgery is done on an outpatient basis, and it's all done vaginally, so there's no cuts or incisions upon the abdomen.
Okay. I have a couple more callers. One of them asks some questions about treatment for overactive bladder, and she comments that some of the side effects of the medication seem worse than the problem itself.
I know. So, it's almost like chemotherapy.
Yeah.
Yes. That's a very common complaint. That entire family of medicines that's commercially available for overactive bladder, meaning the anticholinergic, so just to throw some names out there that you've seen on television, Ditropan, Detrol, Vesicare, Enablex, Toviez, those are all in the same family. And they all tend to have the same side effects. So those are, most importantly, dry mouth and constipation. And those can be very, very debilitating to some patients. When it comes to dealing with the dry mouth, my suggestion is don't start drinking more because that will only make you urinate more and that'll make your problem worse. And it also won't help because you're not dehydrated. So the increase in your fluid intake is not going to help with the dry mouth. So one thing you can do is either chew gum or suck on candies. Just try to get your salivary glands going so the dry mouth isn't as bad. Constipation, you know, we always have fiber that can be added to the diet. You should consume an appropriate amount of water, not too much, not too little, medications that you can take to relieve the constipation. So those are the two most common side effects with those medicines.
Okay. Another email. What is the current treatment of interstitial cystitis? So let's define interstitial cystitis and give us a little bit of information, and then
sure.
What do we know about treatment?
Interstitial cystitis is also known as painful bladder syndrome. Now, we tend to treat interstitial cystitis now based on symptoms, and those can include, the major hallmark is pain with filling of the bladder. So these women tend to urinate frequently because they find if they let the bladder get too full, then they start to experience pain. And this pain should be relieved upon emptying of the bladder, so that makes them feel better. If it's very, very severe, then sometimes this can extend to pain at other times as well. The problem underlying interstitial cystitis is thought to be a defect in the protective coating of the bladder. So kind of like any other organ, or kind of like your stomach, there is a layer of proteins and other types of material that help to coat it and protect it from the agents that are inside your urine. If there are defects in this layer, or if that layer is not present, the things that are dissolved in your urine can tend to leak into the bladder wall and cause a lot of discomfort and pain. So that's thought to be the underlying problem for IC. Many treatments are available. There's only one FDA-approved medication for this called Elmeron, and it's thought that it's a pill that you take that is completely secreted into the urine. So it's thought to coat the bladder and kind of replace that protective layer that was lost for interstitial cystitis.
We have only about 3 minutes left, and I wanted you to make some comments about another group of patients that we have not talked about, and perhaps it'll help these individuals. And those are women who have, you've mentioned to me before the program, multiple sclerosis, and some women who've had back injuries that have affected their spinal cord, or maybe born with injuries that have caused those problems. And I'm just wondering, what percentage of your practice is that? Do we have things to offer that group of people who might be listening?
Permanent spinal cord injury is difficult, and you're just kind of managing the urine, managing the urine output. So unfortunately, a lot of those ladies end up with catheters and just a place to drain the urine conveniently. When it comes to neurologic disorders like multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's, what can happen is that there's a dysregulation of the nerves that feed the bladder and urethra. So sometimes they cause the parts of the bladder not to work well together. Other times they cause the bladder to be underactive or overactive. So there's a very wide constellation of symptoms that can occur with neurologic problems. That's definitely a patient that needs evaluation with urodynamics, because based on just the disease alone, it's almost impossible to predict exactly what problem they have.
Okay. A couple of emails. I'm not sure we'll get to both of them. Let's try this one real quickly. I wanted to share my experience and get your comment. I gained 40 pounds or gained weight during my 40s when I was 47 to 48. I started to have stress incontinence, especially on coughing and sneezing. I joined a weight loss program, lost 35 pounds. My stress incontinence went away.
Fabulous.
After I lost the first 25 pounds. I've been gaining weight back, and now I'm back up a little bit. We don't know where this person started, and I've started to have incontinence again. I feel sure if I lose the weight, it will go away. Again, any comments?
Yes, almost certainly. I agree with you, absolutely. So probably if that weight comes off, the stress incontinence will go away. Yes, sure. But congratulations to you for going through that program. I'm sure you can do it again.
Another caller for a quick question. Latex intolerance and how it may affect urinary health. The caller years ago had a great distress and discomfort because of latex intolerance and manifested urinary incontinence problems, especially associated with condoms, as you might expect.
Okay. Use of condoms causing urinary problems. Latex sensitivities, the only thing to do is avoid it. So, unfortunately.
Is that pretty easy to do nowadays?
Well, latex condoms are what are advised for prevention of STDs. You know, there are certain other, many other things you can do for contraception itself, but for STD protection, we do still advise use of latex condoms. It's a bigger question.
So it is real that you can have latex hypersensitivity.
Yeah, definitely real, and definitely it's possible to have reactions in that particular area.
Okay. Well, thanks again. It's been a pleasure having you here. My guest today is Dr. Andrea Wang of Anchorage, or Alaska Urological Associates, and we very much appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
Thank you, Thad. It's been a pleasure.
Next week, we're going to be talking about the health care of the homeless. My guests will be Sister Jackie Stoll and Susan Bomolowski, both of Catholic Social Services. Please tune into your health and learn more on Monday, July 2nd at 2 p.m. Remember, we repeat each evening, each Monday evening, that is, at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1. For KSKA and for Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. or email us at line1@kska.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at kska.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.